Hello. Hello. Welcome to Home Baking. This podcast is all about adventures in home baking through history, culture, and ingredients. Don't know if you can hear, but there's a lot of building work going on in my block of flats, which I will get onto in a second. And I'm also in, for some reason, I chose to record this in the room with my pet rats who are deciding to drink water extremely noisily. So, apologies for this. Although I think the building noise would happen literally in any room. And last time I said I was going to be talking to you about Brunsviga, and I'm not going to be able to do that today, but I do have an extremely good reason, which is I don't have an oven with no oven. So what's happened is about a week ago or so, we had an engineer come around to fit a meter because our gas meters have been broken or working properly for about 2 years, and we've been kind of hassling the company, or rather, realistically, my partner's been hassling the company for that long to come and fit us with working meters. So they sent around an engineer who meters, but he said he could smell gas coming from somewhere. So he sort of tried to investigate where, but couldn't really confirm it, but it was then investigated by its network that kind of sorts out the pipes and things like that, and they found a leak. So they had to cut off the gas for the entire block of flats, and unfortunately I have a very crappy gas oven, so I can't use my oven. I can't use the hob either, the stove top for my cooker, because that's also gas. We have no hot water, we have no heating. Is that it? I think that might be it. But yeah, it's suboptimal, let's say. Definitely it could be a lot worse. I mean, I'm glad that they found the leak. I'm glad that it's being fixed. I'm glad that it's not very cold at the moment, so not having central heating is not too big of an issue. I'm glad that we've got friends who live in the local area that we can call on to go and get a shower. We go and get a gym membership and shower there or something. But yeah, it definitely could be worse, but it's also, yeah, it's definitely suboptimal. I've been not really a huge fan of. Particularly getting in and out of the bath, you'd think, I don't know, a 35-year-old would be a bit more, would find it easier than I do. Yeah, struggle to get in and out. Got a couple of bruises on my knees to prove it. And then washing up, we have to boil kettles for the washing up. I have to boil kettles to have a bath. I have to boil a kettle to wash my face. It's interesting. I'll say that for it. Yeah, it should be being fixed within the next few days. I can hear them doing loads of work. But basically, they couldn't just repair that. They had to actually move the entire pipe because since that was fitted way back in the 1960s when this building was built, the regulations have changed and you can't have a gas leak going through the main fire escape, which honestly makes sense. So they're having to fit it to the outside of the building. They needed to get emergency planning permission, and they need access to the flat so that it can run into the flat from the wall outside. So it's important that the leak was found, that we aren't gonna so it's really dangerous. It could have been going on quite a long time as well. We don't really know. Extremely old. It was quite a faint smell. Gemma said that, my partner said that she could potentially smell it. But yeah, it's been going on for a long time. I actually had to stop recording and then speak to the gas people on the phone. So yeah, we should be hopefully having gas from tomorrow, Wednesday at the latest. Okay. So anyway, the other thing it's meant is it's been a little bit difficult for us to cook, so a lot of our cooking is oven based because we're not really stirring people. We can't really be bothered with it. So yeah, we're doing a lot of adapting with recipes and also just making more sort of stovetop recipes than we normally would. We've bought an air fryer. Well, it's a bit late in the game because it should be fixed soon. But anyway, so I'm looking, but I am kind of looking forward to experimenting with that. And we will keep it and use it for various things. I think it'll be fun to like dehydrate fruit in it. I think it's really nice to make to sort of roast small amounts of vegetables and things in it. So I think we will still get our use out of it. And obviously it's a lot more economical than heating up an entire oven if you're only doing small amounts. And you can often get a more even cook. So I'm looking forward to it. And we're able to pay for that out of the compensation money. So yeah, all good fun. So what I wanted to talk to you about today is instead of the Brunsviga, I wanted to talk a little bit about foraging. It's springtime, and over spring and summer and autumn, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's spring, and this is sort of a good time to start. So I wanted to just talk to you a little bit about some of my tips that I've learned from more experienced foragers. And then I wanted to talk to you about two things that you can either make in the oven or you can make them on a stovetop. Firstly, using wild garlic that you might have foraged, making wild garlic scones. And then secondly, ricotta pancakes with a berry compote. And even if you just listen for the berry compote, that is worth it in itself because it's so easy and delicious that I absolutely love it. And I love these ricotta pancakes. They're just so much more delicious than my old pancake recipe. And the scones have got a really nice hit of garlickiness. They're really they're quite strong, but like good. And what they want to be eaten warm with plenty of butter. So that's our episode today. Let's get cracking. Let's talk a little bit about foraging to start with, and a few of the tips that I've picked up. So last year I went on a foraging course in April, or actually it was maybe the beginning of May, a spring foraging course, and it was at Tower Hamlets Cemetery Park, which is in Mile End. That probably means nothing to most of you. I'm not really sure why I said that, but anyway, it's a really lovely kind of wild park, I guess is kind of how you might describe it. It's like managed. It's managed, but they don't mow lawns. They don't sort of control too much, and as a result, it's full of lots of interesting flora and fauna. So there are a much greater variety of birds than I would normally see in London. Different insects. It's just really. It's a lovely, lovely place to be as well. It's very calm. Now they actually had signs up that said you shouldn't be foraging when I went last. This is not when I was on the foraging course, because I think so. Foraging's become so popular, and people don't seem to have much education around what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do. But anyway, this foraging course I went on was excellent. Highly recommend if anyone lives in London. It was Ken from the Cemetery Park that did it, and he was fantastic. I learned loads and I really enjoyed it more than I thought I would. It was a present, and I was like, interesting. Okay, let me try this out. But I absolutely loved it. It really improves my mental health to go and walk in nature and to kind of have a purpose. It like gives me a reason to do it as well. Like, oh, I'm gonna go and find some stuff that I can maybe make into some. And I'm not a huge fan of a pointless walk. I like a reason to go for some reason. And it's good to go to somewhere, if you live in an urban area like me, you kind of, or even if you don't, to be honest, you kind of want a wild-ish space. Woodland is particularly good because it has a supports a variety of different forms of life. So here are my tips. So first of all, like I said, people often lack education around what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. It's actually illegal in a lot of places, including in England in most cases. It is, though, often tolerated because if they don't want those plants, you're not kind of doing them any harm or doing the local like flora and fauna any harm, then nobody's going to mind. But yeah, it's not really the... it's not really legal to just go on someone else's land, including if it's like a park or something like that, because then it still belongs to the council or it still belongs to someone, and just take their stuff. Like it's not really the thing. But like I say, it's often tolerated if it's not kind of causing any damage, doing any harm. Where there's land that might be shared with a lot of other people and maybe it's conserved as well, like a lot of the places in London, like wood, the nature reserves and small woods that we have, such as Highgate Wood, the Cemetery Park, then it's even more frowned upon, because if everyone was taking a large amount of plants, it would decimate their plants and it just wouldn't be okay. It's also upsetting the kind of balance of what other creatures and other life forms need. So you just have to do it really carefully. Ask for permission if you can. If you can't, just take a small amount and be mindful and careful about how you do it and respectful of the other life forms in the, you know, in the kind of in the habitat. Having said all that, some of the things that are foraged most often in Britain are actually things that are invasive species and grow almost uncontrollably. So sometimes the landowners are actually very happy for you to take some. So wild garlic really, really grows like really fast, loads of it. Same with tricornered leeks. So often, yeah, people are often happy for you to take them because it might be stopping other plants from growing, or it might be that they've just got such a huge amount that they don't really care. So that's my first tip, is be careful about what you're doing and try and do it legally. Secondly, think about the other like animals, plants, mushrooms, moss, all of the other living things in that habitat that you're foraging in. Like I said, don't take too much. So a kind of good rule of thumb is you never take more than 10% of what you find of a particular thing. And just leave enough for other living things. Leave plenty for other living things that might rely on that food source. Thirdly, if you want to particularly if you want to gather things like berries or edible flowers, it's best to go in the morning. By the afternoon, the birds and bees might have taken all the best things. And the fruit, there might be not as much fruit, ripe fruit, or the flowers will have less nectar, so they won't be as good. And if you're picking flowers, then from trees, this is the kind of flowers I mean, then you might want to take a separate little box for them. Or it could be other edible flowers as well, I guess. But yeah, you might want a separate little box to sort of keep them nice so that they're not just being mashed around in your bag. And then I just tend to take a bag for leaves, and then I just treat it carefully, like I would if I was buying a bag of salad from the supermarket. I just sort of treat it carefully. My fourth tip is that you really kind of need a good base of knowledge before you start gathering anything. So it can be self-taught, right, through books, through people on the internet. It could be through somebody helping you who's more experienced, going on a course, Whatever kind of informal or formal education, it doesn't really matter as long as you've got the basics. And then if you've forgotten, and that should also kind of needs to be specific to the area that you're in as well, because you'll have different, there'll be different common things that you can forage. And what a plant is, there's loads of apps nowadays that can help with plant identification. I use something called Picture This, which is always trying to sell me the paid for version, but I just stick to the free version and it works fine. It doesn't have all the information, but I can then, it tells me the name of the plant, it tells me some basics, and then I can go and Google the plant if I'm not sure about anything. Other foragers I've come across use other apps as well. So, for example, there's one called iNaturalist, spelt letter I, naturalist, all one word. But the key thing is obviously never eat anything that you aren't 100% sure is edible. Don't risk it. If it isn't going to kill you, it might make you ill, which is still not very fun. And lots of toxic plants look like edible plants. So for me, I know a bit about leaves. I know a bit about kind of tree flowers, because that's kind of what I was taught about. If I was to decide, do you know what, I want to start foraging mushrooms, I would go on another course, or I would do loads of research, because it would be very easy to kill myself, basically, doing that. So just be really sure about what you're eating. I'm sure that kind of goes without saying. But they do often really look like each other. So when we were foraging the other week, we saw loads of a type of lily, but the flower really does look a lot like the flower of tricornered leek, so we had to be super careful about what we were doing. And my fifth tip is, if you're in an urban area or it's a park where there's walking routes that others use, or a reserve where there's walking routes that others use, etc., always pick well away from paths, particularly if it's things that are on the ground. Obviously, this is to avoid stuff like that dogs might have weed on or pooed on, or that humans have trampled on, because they might be carrying nasty, nasty bugs on their shoes. And then when you get home, you still want to wash the produce as well and pick through it while you're doing that, and remove anything that you've picked unintentionally. Any leaves from another plant, for example, that have got mixed up with the leaves from whichever plant you were trying to get, that does happen. And you just need to separate them out so you're not eating anything that you can't digest or that's going to be dangerous. And then finally, linking back to the previous point about education, try and find out what you can forage in your area. Find local foragers, find people that you can follow on social media, perhaps, or people you can make friends with, or it might be an internet forum, just so that you've got a good source of kind of specific knowledge about your like area. Because what people will be foraging in, I don't know, Brazil is going to be completely different from what they're foraging. So it's really good of local knowledge. All right, so those are my little foraging tips. Next up, we're going to talk about wild green garlic scones. So wild garlic is called ramps in North America, I think. It's got many names. Lots of plants have got multiple names. And for these scones, I used mostly what, but because I found some other alliums, I did throw a few leaves of the other alliums in too. So I used a few, I don't know, a handful of tricornered leek leaves, and also a few garlic mustard leaves. And you can kind of mix and match with anything that's got a soft leaf, is mild flavoured, and it's a wild allium. Anything like that, you can use. And this scone recipe, it's changed slightly since I did a scone episode, which is quite a while ago now, but I've slightly increased the butter, figuring that more butter is really bad, at least in flavour. It might be worse for my arteries. So if you want to have a 3-to-1 ratio instead of 2-to-1, you know, you're watching your fat intake, then you can do that, absolutely. You can even use a vegan butter. if you want, and that'll reduce the saturated fat if that's a concern for you. And so, for example, with this, there's 450 grams of flour. So you could do 150 grams of butter for a slightly leaner scone, or for a more buttery scone, you can do what I did, which is 225 grams of butter. I've also included how to make these on the stovetop or hob, because as previously discussed, I don't have an oven currently, and it really worked surprisingly well. It was a bit of an experiment, and I just thought, you know what, if I can make English muffins on the stove, why can't I cook scones on it? You know, there's plenty of breads that you can cook on a hob, so I just thought, why not? And it did actually work really well. But I've also included instructions on how to bake it as well. And if you want the written recipes, then do go to homebaking.substack.com, because that's where I publish them. And then also, while you're there, you can sign up to the newsletter and get all of this sent to your inbox on a regular basis. All right. So in terms of the ingredients for this, you want between 50 and 75 grams of the leaves of a wild allium. Mine were quite strong, so I just thought I'd give you the option of using a bit less if you wanted a slightly more mild scone. It did make them a beautiful green, and it does have quite a nice funky flavour. But if you just wanted it a tiny bit less pungent, you could do that. 50 grams of plain or 225 grams of salted butter, or you can use an unsalted butter and add a pinch of salt. 50 grams of pecorino, or another hard salty cheese, kind of grated on the second largest side of a box grater, so slightly finer grate, and a tablespoon of baking powder, and then about 200 grams of milk or so. You just want enough milk to bind it together, no more. And then if you are using an oven, you might want to egg wash these to get a nice brown top. So you might want an egg yolk, that egg yolk out, like maybe just a bit of the white from the egg, or it could be water, or it could be milk, or it even could be cream. All right, so we're going to make them. If you're using an oven, you're going to preheat it to 190 degrees C, 170 C fan or 375 Fahrenheit, line a couple of baking trays. If you're using the stovetop or hob, you want to just find a frying pan with a bit of depth and a lid that fits it, and then just sort of set that to one side so that you're ready. Then next, I want you to do some prep. So you need to shred your leaves. You could just chop these finely by hand, or you could blitz them in a small food processor in batches, but you don't want to make a mulch. So the aim is to chop them finely rather than making like a pesto or something, which you could make, and that would be delicious on a pasta, but with some, obviously you'd mix through oil as well. But if you're making scones, you don't really want to make a sort of mulchy thing. But you equally, you don't want large pieces. So especially if you're using tri-cornered leeks, they can be stringy. And whatever you're using, it's not really going to bake quite as nicely if they've got any large pieces. And make sure you've grated the cheese if you haven't already. Next up, you're going to start making your scones. So rub the butter into the flour. So you can use the tips of your fingers and thumbs. You could use a pastry cutter. You could use a food processor and just pulse it a few times. Whatever you prefer is fine, until you've kind of got that like rough breadcrumb consistency. Then you want to just bring that dough together with the liquid. So I've just used whole milk. You could actually use buttermilk. You could use potentially a plant-based milk. Wouldn't be as rich, but it would still be nice. It would still be a good scone. Up to you. So just drizzle over like most of that milk, maybe 150 grams or so, and then use your hands to press the dough together, and then add more as necessary. So depending on your flour and how wet your kind of leaves are and stuff like that, it might not need as much. I forgot to say that you're going to need to stir in your leaves into your butter and flour mixture before you add this liquid. So yeah, you might need more or less depending. You just want to be able to bring it into a ball, okay? And then once you've brought that into a ball, you might want to rest that dough in the fridge, covered or wrapped, or you could just simply proceed if it's not too hot. As long as the butter isn't sort of melting on your hands, it's kind of fine. But if if it's easier for you for some reason, in between other jobs maybe, you can definitely go and rest that dough for a while, that's fine. Then you're going to shape your dough. So you can choose, if you want to roll it out and then cut scones out. I personally can't be bothered with that, and I don't like waste, and I don't like re-rolling. So I just sort of tear off lumps, fashion them into a circular shape. You could also make them into wedges, so you could like pat it into a nice, circle and then cut it into small wedges. My lumps are about 85 grams each to make about 12 small scones, but you could do slightly bigger, but it obviously bear in mind that it'll take longer to cook. All right, so those are your scones made. And then if you are using the oven, you might, as I said, you might want to put a bit of an egg wash on top. So brush a bit of beaten egg yolk thinned with something like a teaspoon of milk, egg white, water, cream, and just brush that on the top. And or if you don't have any egg, you could actually also use cream or milk or buttermilk if you can, as egg yolk will, but it'll still be a nice, it's still quite nice to do. And then pop the scones on baking trays and bake for about 20 minutes. Turn it halfway through if needed, if your oven bakes unevenly, etc. And that should be nice and golden brown, but still quite green and baked throughout. If you're using the hob like I did, you don't need to egg wash because you're going to fry it on both sides. So you're sort of fry. So you are going to put a non-stick or a pan that isn't sticky, so it might be a seasoned skillet, on a medium heat. And then once it's heated up a bit, put a few of the scones in and then just cover it with a lid. And what will happen is the scones will cook in some of their own butter, but it won't all leak out. It works super well. So cover that with a lid, cook it for 5 minutes, then turn them over using a spatula and cook them and then cover them again. Cook it for a further 5 minutes. So you want 10 minutes or 5 minutes per side. You will need to do batches unless you are using lots of pans. And it will get beautifully golden brown. So to serve it, you want to just let them cool just a bit, but they're really lovely warm. That's the best way to eat them, I think. Spread. And you can also freeze these. They freeze very, very well. All scones do. And you can reheat them from cold or from frozen before you serve them, just in like a medium oven. Or you could maybe start the defrosting in a microwave. But you want to finish it in an oven. Otherwise, they can get a bit greasy and nasty. So those are our wild garlic scones, the ricotta pancakes. So this is my adaptation of Rukmini Iyer's adaptation of the Curtis Stone ricotta pancakes. Said the word scone too many times, clearly. And I've made it with my berry compote. So my kind of standard berry compote is like literally the easiest recipe ever. It's two ingredients, if you can, because it actually works better. It's lower in sugar than jams or even conserves. It's lower in sugar than those. But you can keep it in a jar in the fridge for about a week. And it's just fantastic on pancakes as well. It's good with granola. It's good with yogurt. It's lovely. So these pancakes are kind of silky textured. So they have baking powder in. They do rise a bit. But I wouldn't actually describe them as fluffy. I think there's too much fat and in there really and too much liquid for them to get really, really fluffy. But I kind of prefer them this way. So you don't need as much syrup because they're a bit more moist, and they're just loads of my kind of standard parrot pancakes that I used to make, standard thick pancakes. So I'm kind of evangelical about them. I think they're better this way, even though it might not be the fluffy texture that you're used to. And so to make these, you want to have about 50 grams of butter. If you're using, and then once again, we're going to have two methods. One is like making one big pancake, like a tray bake in the oven. The other method is to make them on the stove and fry them so you can make a nice stack. So you want about 50 grams of butter, and that is to fry the pancakes in, or to kind of grease that pan really well, aren't you in the oven, I guess, in the butter. You're cooking it in butter. So you want butter, 250 grams of ricotta. That's a really convenient amount for me because that's what the packet comes in, so I just use the packet. You want 4 free-range eggs. So I have tried this with UK medium eggs and UK large eggs, which are equivalent to US, Australia, Canada large or extra large. And if you have larger eggs, you can just use a little less milk. That's what I found. So you want to get a nice dropping consistency, so it's kind of plops out, right? Maybe a bit like a yogurt kind of consistency. So it wants to be thicker than double cream, because double cream consistency is like a crepe. So you want it like a kind of drop, right? So that it plopped into the pan and doesn't spread out too much. But you also don't want it to be like too solid, you know? So you kind of have to go by eye, I reckon, particularly if you're using a different size of egg. Then you want, like 150 to 200 grams of milk, roughly. 40 grams of caster sugar or granulated, either's fine. 150 grams and 1 teaspoon of baking powder. So that's our pancake batter. For our compote, we want to have, now this is enough to make just for this, just for the pancakes, and it's to serve about 4. If you wanted to have some for the rest of the week, which I frequently do, you might want to kind of upscale this a bit. So rule of thumb is you use 20% of the weight of the berries. So the easiest way to do this in terms of mental arithmetic is to take 1/10 and then times that by 2. So for example, if it's 200 grams of berries, obviously 10% of that is 20 grams. So 20% of that is going to be 40 grams. So I've said 200 grams of frozen raspberries, blackberries, sweet cherries, or blueberries, or you could have a mix. I wouldn't do this with sour cherries because you'll need more sugar. So this isn't the best recipe for that. And I wouldn't do this with strawberries because they're more watery. So the recipe wouldn't quite work as well. But you could definitely experiment with it with strawberries. And then it's 40 grams of sugar. If you want to do upscale it to have some more compote left over, feel free. It's just honestly so good in the morning on your yogurt and granola or whatever. So I sometimes will get a 350 gram bag and then I will put 70 grams of sugar in. And then to serve with the pancakes and compote, you might want a bit of maple syrup, a bit of Greek yogurt. You also might prefer to use icing sugar or another type of syrup or whipped cream if you're going to be really indulgent. Up to you what you kind of serve it with. But my favourite is a bit of maple syrup. So to make your compote, you want to do this first, I think, get it out of the way. Put your berries in a saucepan, cover them with sugar, stir those two together, and then start heating them quite gently, so on a low to medium heat, And then you don't need to add any water because as the berries heat, they start releasing loads of juice, particularly if they're frozen. And then you shouldn't really need to, you shouldn't need to add water. And then you bring that to a simmer, gently, sort of fairly gentle simmer. You don't want it boiling necessarily. And then just kind of stir it every now and then, you know, every couple of minutes. Make sure it's not sticking to the bottom and burning. And make sure it's kind of nicely cooking evenly, and also it's reducing. And so you can adapt this recipe and make it as reduced as you want. If you are going for something reduced, the best way to go is low and slow. You don't want to go hot and fast because you'll just end up burning whatever's on the bottom of the pan. But you definitely want the berries to be soft and you want the sauce to be thickened. So I find that it takes about 6 to 8 minutes, maybe more if you're making a larger amount. And you can reduce it further for another 1 to 2 minutes, if you like, off the heat and set it aside. Then you want to make your batter. So you want to whisk your ricotta with your eggs and sugar until you've got an even consistency. Then I would whisk in the baking powder because I find it whisks in more evenly if you whisk it before the flour, even that might sound odd. Then I whisk in the flour and then gradually whisk in the milk until you get that dropping consistency I was talking about. If it's thin, it will spread out too much and you won't get a nice texture inside. And like I said, depending on the size of your eggs, you might need somewhere between 150 grams and 200 grams of milk. And you can do this all by hand as well, which is nice, not to have to get any machinery out in the morning. And then you just want to cook your pancakes. They don't really need any resting time, these pancakes, I don't think. You can just kind of crack straight on. So if you are using the oven to do a big tray bake pancake, you're going to pop the butter into a roasting tin and then put it into your cold oven and then preheat the oven. And then what should happen, hopefully, is by the time the oven is preheated, by the time the butter is melted, the oven will hopefully be preheated. Or you can just, if it take out the butter once it's melted because you don't want it to burn, let it hang out. If it gets too cold, you can stick it back in for a minute, but if it starts hardening up. You will, once the oven's preheated, pour in the batter and then bake it for about 25 to 30 minutes until golden and well risen. Once again, you might want to turn it around halfway through depending on your oven's reliability. If you're doing these on the stovetop or the hob, you will want to have quite a large frying pan, so you can do maybe 3 at a time or so depending on the size of them. And put a knob of butter in the pan. With this method, you're kind of adding butter as you go rather than putting it all in at once. Melt that butter. When it's sizzling, you can start ladling in dollops of mixture. It might take a little bit of practice to make sure your heat level is good, the consistency of the heat is good enough to get good pancakes. Turn them over once you can see that they've set around the edges, and there should also be some bubbles on top. And then flip it over, cook it for a couple more minutes until it's golden brown on both sides. And then what I do to keep them warm is I have a plate with silver foil, a big strip of silver foil, and I wrap them in silver foil. And then every time it's done, I sort of unwrap it, put the pancakes in, wrap it again, just to keep them warm. And I find the residual heat really does do a good job at keeping them all warm. If not, you can also reheat these in the oven, or if you want to make these ahead, for example, or even in the microwave, but I think they're a slightly less nice consistency if you reheat them in the microwave. And then to serve them, you're going to want to reheat your compote so that it's warm, and then plop that onto your warm pancakes with syrup and yogurt as wanted. You can actually use the compote cold on pancakes as well if you want, but it's up to you. So that's our pancakes, and that's all of the kind of baking or really cooking There's no oven. No, because I didn't use an oven. So, I had no oven. So that's the recipes for today. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about what's coming up next. We'll be closing up the episode. So next episode, we will be talking hopefully about Brunsviga finally. Now, I have made this a few times, but it has taken me a bit of practice to get the technique right. So I really want to pass on my tips and knowledge to you guys when we're finally ironed out any of my issues. And can kind of confidently say, like, this works well, you know? So I've made them 3 or 4 times already. That's why I couldn't do this episode, even though, like, I have had an oven for 3 weeks out of this month. but I hadn't quite done enough testing to be happy. So I'm going to make it 1 or 2 more variations, and then we can talk about it in the next ep. So that's what's going to come up next. I really want to do a bit more history in the future. So I think I'm going to talk as well about the kind of where Brunsviga comes from, how it's served traditionally, and stuff like that as well. Within that episode, we could talk a little bit about Scandinavian baking. Always good. So I'm really looking forward to that, and looking forward to talking to you once again. And just a little reminder to sign up better. homebaking.substack.com, please. And then you can get the written recipes there too. And I hope that you're taking care, looking after yourself, and things are okay where you are. So yeah, take care, happy baking. Bye-bye.